So when I first got asked to talk here, they said, just talk about your stuff. And I thought, okay, so what do I do in my spare time? And it turns out that what I do in my spare time is get annoyed about stuff and try to fix it. So I figure that's pretty much common around here. And the thing that I get really badly annoyed about is the fact that there are these massive development agencies, big aid agencies out there, and they're not doing their job properly. There are guys on the ground who aren't getting the support they need. Things are broken. And the sort of things that are broken are these. So communities are broken. There are no communities in some areas. When I first started, about 3 years ago, there were people across the UN whose job was to deal with information and communication who weren't talking to each other. That sort of broke. Processes get broken. There are people out there who are by hand, every time they pull down a data set from the UN, cleaning the data set. That is no way efficient. A lot of the stuff is rooted back in 50 years ago worth of processes, before we had all these instantaneous communication methods. Tech, quite often just missing in action. Now, a lot of it just isn't there yet. Even for the mappers, it's not there yet. Now, there's stuff that you'd think was pretty fundamental, like having online real-time volunteer management systems that connect together all of the systems that we use to track everybody, and please somebody tell me it exists. Please, because I'm building the damn thing. And innovation. You've got this mix of people being afraid to innovate because these are very old-fashioned systems. And I used to be an innovations manager back in my history. I suppose I ought to have told you what I do in the daytime, which is design, build, play with development tech. But back in the day, I worked for a very large engineering company, and there was something called the corporate immune system. So as soon as somebody comes up with a new idea that changes the way that people do things as it is, this immune system kicks in and kind of shuts them out. So we're seeing corporate immune systems, we're seeing people afraid to innovate, we're seeing people who don't realise they can. So a lot of systems bust. And when I say system, I mean all of those things, not just tech. It's never just tech. You have to fix the whole lot, sometimes at once. So some of the stuff that's broken in this field, and I've just picked on three bits, so there are lots more. So development data. You've got stuff in PDFs, you've got stuff on HTML pages, you've got stuff even on... Help! I've gone off. No, I haven't. You've got stuff that's effectively on bits of paper and sitting on people's laptops because nobody's thought to pull it off and put it somewhere you can get at it. So it's access to it. There's some data which should be available to the world, or at least to the countries it's about, that's locked up behind firewalls. The coverage. When you're talking about development indicators, the things that tell you how healthy a country is. I mean, it's stupid. No, simple stuff, like what is your infant mortality rate? The way that that's gathered at the moment is somebody walks up and down streets in an area and goes house to house, a household survey, with a form, fills out the form, goes to the next place with a form, goes to... That's not a representative survey. It's starting to get fixed. We're starting to get mobile-based surveys. And yeah, that man there probably knows a lot more than I do about it. No? You're running away, Noel. but we need better coverage. Every time I go mapping, we're getting about one layer down. So we've got country data, we can probably get down to state. If we want to know what's happening in a city, it's quite difficult just getting at that level of data. Standards. You'll see those in a minute. They're all over the bloody place. Quite often there is no standard, and people just make them up as they go along, and sometimes they don't even bother with that. Data sources. There's a whole pile of data out there. I mean, crisis mapping is all about finding the data sources that the official data ignores and starting to use them. Disconnects between humans and data. You've got a whole bunch of experts, usually field experts, who know something's going on, And they've got a bunch of other experts who are analysing data about it who don't actually connect at that level. They only connect up several layers up where you've got a report level. So it disconnects there. Crisis data. There's a disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what's happening out remotely. Crisis mapping, when it first started, kind of exacerbated that a little. Haiti was a lot of organisations all trying to help at once and not knowing who they were trying to help. So you've got disconnects between the crisis and development. You've got the cycles. You've got development, crisis, early recovery, late recovery, going back through to development. And the data isn't being passed from stage to stage on that. Again, it should be. Again, it's technically possible, but the technologies are just coming through, and the political forces that make it difficult to do that. Which then, I guess, we're coming down to the community things. You're coming... Okay. One last crisis, one which is deployment lead overloads. I may lead, core team lead, in the Standby Task Force, which is one of the big crisis mapping groups. As part of my duties, I lead deployments. So I have 1,000 people in the team. Sometimes we've got several hundred. We bring in external teams. You're running up to 10 teams at once. And you're trying to run chats. You're trying to maintain communications across all of those. And it's bloody hard. Again, we need tech for that. And the community thing. If you're looking at the big agencies, you get soapbites. You get one agency, won't talk to the next one. Quite often, I've actually had them tell me that they're not allowed to without going through their partnership office, talk to each other. So we need ways to break that. We've been building ways to break that. Fiefdoms, you quite often, again, you get these enclosed spaces. Imperialism. One thing that I get a bit passionate about is treating people as people, wherever the hell they are. I was out in Nigeria last year, and there are some brilliant techs out there who just aren't connected into the grid yet. They're very capable, very bright, but they're not part of our world yet, and they should be. They really should be. Nairobi, they've done it. Places like the iHub, people like the Akira Chicks, which is a women's programming group in Nairobi, they're connected in. But they're like us, just don't happen to be in New York. And one of the traps you can fall into is being imperial in your thinking, is to think, I'll just go help those people over there. I'll just go work with those people over there to help them to help themselves. It is kind of the way I try to think of it. And actually just finding the community. So those guys in Nairobi had no idea that there were women around the world watching them. It's like they were just plain shocked that we were watching their Twitter feed. Right, so that's kind of the broken bits. Here's some of the bits we've been doing on it. Development data. So here's a bit of work we did last year on crisis indicators, which scraping. So we scraped a load of stuff, we shoved it into CSVs because everyone can read a CSV. We put indicators for a country that the crisis was just kicking off in. So we were doing with the Democratic Republic of Congo. We then got a remote team, to go looking for more data beyond that with the official data sets we had. And then we gave it to an analyst to produce a beautiful, beautiful report. You'll see a lump of that a bit later. I've just got that system up online, which is kind of cool. Data access. There's a hell of a problem with data licenses across development data. I know. I have taken a complete data set and tried to track back where it all came from and track back the licenses for where it all came from. And actually, it turned out to be quite kosher. But there was no... You actually had to go hand by hand. I mean, literally reading the corners of maps that people had used to get their that logs from to find out whether they were supposed to have used that data or not. That's got to change. I mean, especially if you want people who are actually in the countries to be able to get access to their own data again. So most stuff isn't even a one star at the moment. We're trying to get it somewhere near a three star. It's a bit of a hole. Cleaning it. Last year, USAID opened up their funding data. In fact, they opened up the geographical descriptions they had of their funding data, which were quite colloquial in places, to crowdsource them. So they actually cleaned a bunch and then they had crowdsourcing for the bits they had left over. That was great. Great thing for them to do. We need more of that. Standardising. DR Congo. The top list are all the names of the Democratic Republic of Congo in the data.un.org dataset. I scraped data.un.org and then built cleaners for the country names. And the bottom set is all the names of the Democratic Republic of Congo in the common standard set. And that's before you get to the fact that it's a French-speaking country and you've then got local names for it as well. So what the hell do you call this thing? You know, just agree on a standard for something as simple as a country name is hard. Imagine agreeing on standards for place names, for, well, that's all sorts of bits of data we need to deal with. But once you've done that, you can start cross-correlating. So this is a bit of work that we did at the IATI hackathon. IATI are the data standards for aid transparency, so they're basically tracking the money. So we took all the well data we had, the water sources data we had in South Sudan, and we tracked that against the aid data where people had declared they'd been digging wells and tried to work out, you know, how far people were from wells, whether they'd actually been served or not. The usual things happened. People had built wells, oh, whoops, next to their headquarters. It's, again, you've got to make this stuff transparent, because if it's not transparent, if you can't track it, it's not accountable. You don't get these stories. And this money is supposed to be going to help people who have, you know, the biggest way to come, to be treated like the rest of us, just to have the basics. Now, this is, it's not play money, it's not, this is people's lives. You know, sorry, I get kind of annoyed. As I said, this is my list of things I get annoyed about. And that's the start of one of the analyst reports from the disaster needs analysis sheets. This is the stuff that came off the indicator data. So it's beautiful stuff. Am I talking too much yet? Crisis data. So typical workflow on that. We're about to map the Kenyan elections. We're expecting a touch of trouble. Yeah. So we're working with... I'm British, I understate. We're working with the IHOPE in Nairobi. We're working with the Shahidi, who are based out of Nairobi. So they have teams on the ground that they're sending out to report back. I don't know if you can see it, but we have media monitoring teams who are checking all the main media feeds. So we're looking at Twitter, Facebook, and anything else that's coming through. Blogs are longer time frames. We're basically looking for the very short pieces of information that tells us something's kicking off. We ran a... test deployment last year on the by-elections, and we had things like had election officials removed from post during the election because they were frigging the votes. I will think of the real word for frigging, but they were basically cheating, and it went up on Twitter, it got caught, it got sent back. It's probably been through three countries before it got back, but it got back in time. We've got people SMSing, so sending text messages in, translators, because we've got, I think, 16 languages running, and text speak as well, which gets a bit exciting for a machine translation. Geolocation, because you've got to find the stuff. As soon as you map something, you have a powerful tool, because you can show people what's happening around them. And then reporting through. That actually needs to go to somebody. So, quick breakdown on those bits. Finding stuff, we do a lot of that. This is hospitals across Libya for the Libya crisis, post-Libya crisis, actually working out what was still standing and still functional. And where it was. Listening to people. SMS feed coming in on one of the deployments. I think this is one of the test deployments, which I got away with the data. Sometimes you have to estimate. This is an indicator estimator across Afgoye in Somalia. Question was, how many people in the Afgoye region have moved out of Mogadishu? Where are they? The UN couldn't physically get in there, but it needed to know where to send the aid. So this was a Christmas. We do tend to do Christmas deployments. So this is Christmas where a bunch of us spent the whole Christmas with a tile at a time mapping every single building, every single shack, every single small house, every single large building across the whole of the Afgoye region. And that gave you a population estimate, a detailed population estimate for the humanitarian guys to go in. Finding stuff. You always need to go find stuff. But you also need a map. And this is Haiti before and after, because Haiti 2010 is where pretty much everyone started. So it's the open street map. And yeah.
Hold on, what year? Is that 2010?
2010. That was a couple of weeks in 2010. Literally, days. I mean, I was running Crisis Camp London at the time. And we had a table in the middle of the room where one end of it was a team of people who were dot by dot tracing lines and finding road names in Haiti. And the other end was an OpenStreetMap team who were fixing the code to make it easy for the guys at the other end doing the lines. So we kind of get involved in that too. And cross-correlating with existing data. This is all of the people escaping out of, as it looks like, DR Congo. And then use maps. Maps are the ones everybody sees, but we also put up analysis reports, visualizations as well. So we have teams that do that. And I've got to 15 minutes, so I'll do a brief bit on communities. Something else I care a lot about. If you build a community, there's nothing for those people in that community, and there's nothing to stop them talking to each other. There isn't that. You've got to go through the partnership office, you just happen to be having a beer together, you just happen to be talking about things that affect you both. If you build an international community, you start understanding each other. I spend way too much time chatting to a guy who's a paramedic on a bike out in Ghana, because he's part of our community. He kind of tells us what it's like out there. And the problems they have. And you know, again, it's guys like us. Just guys like us, just in different countries. Supporting communities, I'm probably mentioned, I'm one of the Standby Task Force leads. And one of the decisions we took for this year was to open up all the processes and procedures that we use to run deployments so that we can train other people up to do it too. So this is a sneak preview of our workflow and protocol page. Pretty boring, but we've been typing like crazy since Christmas. And this is a bit of the day job stuff. So one of the things I said about the disconnects was the disconnects between the human experts, the guys on the ground who've seen, you know, a bunch of people, refugees passing through, or they've seen the crop fails, or you know, weird insects, whatever. Whatever that's starting an indicator that there's a crisis coming through. Combining that with the data that's coming through off the social media sniffers, off the official data. And one thing we designed, a while back now, was a system to combine those two different types of information. And we did that by putting the data feeds inside agents, intelligent agents, so that they act in the same way, the same level as the human beings, but they're just slightly weird human beings. Another bit of my background is I used to design unmanned vehicle systems. Specifically, I used to design the ways that teams of human beings and robots would work together. So we've applied that back to how do we put that back into development? You know, this bugger this military stuff, let's see how we can do this for the world. And we did our first test 2 weeks ago, so cool that. And I'm done. I've made it inside 20 minutes, and over to you guys for questions. I'll put more links in.
Great.
And since I'm one of the web admins for the Standby Task Force, I'll just square it with them later about that page.
What are you looking for from a community marketing?
I'm building a lot of tech myself. Some of it may be because I don't know the tech that I need exists. That's an important thing to learn. Another one is just some help here, guys. And we're trying to build the tech. We have split the Standby Task Force now, or are about to, probably haven't announced it yet, but what the hell, into a trained central group So we have volunteers will come and do the training and be part of the teams and do very specialised work, but also a more ad hoc occasional group that comes up and does microtasking. That's not so specialised, doesn't need such specialist skills. I haven't found a good real-time volunteer management application yet. We've got Ning, we've got Skype, we've got Google Groups. I've been building my own connectors through their APIs, and the Skype API is painful. If you start trying to do any of the group stuff with it, the Ning version of JSON, I had to write my own, basically, my own interpreters for it. That sort of pain I don't need on top of the trying to run the group.
And this group's online, or you have a presence in New York City?
The group is online. The presence in New York City is Crisis Mappers New York, because there are several major crisis mapping groups. And I felt we needed a place where all of us could just talk to each other and not have a hat on, just talk and share and just learn from each other.
Where is that?
That's virtual. Meetup.com. In fact, if you look on the bottom line there, that's where it is. And I just happen to be the lead for that at the moment, because I haven't found anybody else stupid enough to take it on. Sorry.
Have you tried Google Hangouts?
We try that. One of the problems with Google Hangouts is that we have very large numbers of people. The standby task force is 1,000 strong. We can get hundreds coming in. Once you get over about 30, you start breaking. Even Skype chats, I'm starting to design grouped Skype chats, because we're going to hit the 2,000 person limit in the next couple of years, and they don't cope after that.
Is IRC not really an option?
IRC is an option if we've got an easy way for the volunteers to get in. We are talking about a lot of very non-technical people.
Right.
Really non-technical. People who get scared by tech.
Sure.
I should have raised this when we were talking before the meeting, but I actually had been speaking about 5 years ago. I had a bunch of discussions with everybody from FEMA people to Salvation Army people in this whole scene. And one of the pieces of software, and the aim was to make it kind of intermodal, was Sahana.
Yeah, we know Sahana very well.
Okay. So there was a whole bunch of people. One of the issues was, obviously, if you can't do TCP, then, you know, how else are you going to do it? And I know they were looking at multiple ways, and, you know, ham radio scene to, you know, IPsec and everything in between.
Yeah, we're still talking to all of those two. Northern Pakistan, when the Pakistan floods hit in 2010, the only communications left for the Northern Pakistan was ham radio. So we've been looking at carriers and connectors from there, from ham to Ushahidi, for a while. They're a good bunch of people. They've also quietly become part of disaster response.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Sarah. That was very amazing.